I'm Audie Cornish, host of The Assignment, a new weekly podcast from CNN. We're going to talk about things you might not want to bring up at the dinner table, from the economy of sex work to the politics of school boards.
We need more critical thinking. We need to be teaching our kids to think for themselves.
Unless a parent thinks it's inappropriate. Then they can make a phone call to a tip line, right? And say, I didn't like the way that went down.
And that's a discussion to be had between the school board and the parent.
Conversations with everyday people who don't make the headlines, they live them. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on Spotify.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world. Missing Justice is an investigative true crime podcast from CBS News that examines the death of Christy Woodenthigh. On the night she was killed, Christy's family rushed to the scene in the Northern Cheyenne region and found no officers, no sirens, and no sign of Christy. This 6-episode series takes you inside what really happened that night and how the issues in Christy's case connect to the larger missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Listen to Missing Justice on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on The World, a bombing in a Pakistan mosque. In the city of Peshawar, the Pakistani Taliban ramps up its campaign against the government.
We've seen attacks in the outskirts of Peshawar, but nothing of the sort that happened today.
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, protests continue in Peru. The interruption to daily life is taking an economic toll. This woman exports avocados and says her business is going bust. Now she's protesting against the protesters. Plus, the player in India's political opposition grabs attention by going on foot, a 2,000-mile trek across the country.
People like the idea of a leader going to the people.
Rahul Gandhi tries to unite Indians, and we wrap up the tennis excitement down under. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us. We begin this Monday in Pakistan, where earlier today a suicide bomber set off explosives at a mosque in the city of Peshawar, not far from the border with Afghanistan. At least 59 people were killed and more than 150 others were wounded. The Pakistani Taliban is claiming responsibility. It is the latest in a wave of attacks since the militant group ended a ceasefire with Pakistan's government in November. Ismail Khan is a journalist who was in Peshawar today. He's an editor with the Pakistani newspaper Dawn.
Well, it happened around afternoon, the afternoon prayer time. And the mosque was located inside the fortified area, a single exit and entry point. We're still trying to figure out, you know, how did the suicide bomber manage to sneak in? This is something the police is still investigating. But this was big, and we've been having an uptick in terrorist attacks ever since the Afghan Taliban took over in Kabul. We've seen attacks in the outskirts of Peshawar, but nothing of the sort that happened today.
So the Pakistani Taliban, also known as the TTP, they've taken responsibility for this attack. Remind us who this group is, the Pakistani Taliban, and why they would attack this mosque.
TTP is a conglomerate, umbrella organization of the many militant groups which were operating in Pakistan's tribal areas adjacent to Afghanistan. And after military operation, they were driven out and they took refuge in Afghanistan, and they were there in the border areas in Afghanistan, from where they continued to launch attacks inside Pakistan. And, you know, the Pakistanis were hoping that with Afghan Taliban taking over, they would try and rein in the TTP or the Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan because they were allies. This is one of the main contentious issues between the Pakistanis and the Afghan Taliban at the moment.
So the TTP, what do they want?
They've been demanding different things from Pakistan, enforcement of Sharia in Pakistan. They've been questioning the status the merger of the tribal areas into Pakistan and all sorts of those things. They don't want to disband. They want to come to Pakistan, but they want to come armed. They want freedom to operate. And those were the things that Pakistanis drew a line in. They said, you know, the constitution of Pakistan does not allow armed groups or, you know, some of the demands that the TTP was presenting. So the talks collapsed.
How well have Pakistan's security forces responded to these stepped up attacks by the TTP?
Well, I mean, you see, the problem was that many people thought within the government that the TTP was taking advantage of the ceasefire and were trying to regroup. But the thing was that the TTP never actually abided by the ceasefire. They continued their attacks. And every time the government would question the rationale about the attack, the TTP would make excuses that the attack was carried out in self-defense and in retaliation to the government's operation. But the bottom line was that the demands the TTP presented were unacceptable.
Going forward, Ismail, has the government in Islamabad given any indication what kind of action they will take to respond to today's mosque bombing?
No, I think we're still discussing. The Prime Minister was here. He was in Peshawar. The Army Chief, General Asim Munir, was here in Peshawar, and they took stock of the situation. They spoke with Provincial Police Chief and the Chief Minister and everybody, discussing what has happened. And I think sooner or later, expecting some meeting in Islamabad to take stock of this situation. The government could have lived with small-time attacks here and there, but this one is big. And I think there'll be some serious discussions happening at the political level and at the military and intelligence level, and some sort of policy will come.
We've been speaking with Ismail Khan. He's an editor for the Pakistani newspaper Dawn. He joined us from Peshawar, where a suicide bomber attacked a mosque earlier today. Ismail, thank you very much for the latest details.
Thank you.
Today marks 75 years since the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, often known as India's father of the nation. Today, a different Gandhi, no relation, is fighting for change. Rahul Gandhi is the face of the Indian National Congress Party and Prime Minister Narendra Modi's biggest political rival. Back in September, Gandhi began a long walk from the southern tip of India all the way to Kashmir and India's mountainous north, where he ended the march today. Sushmita Pathak tells us what this long journey is all about.
The Golconda family woke up at 3 a.m. They prepared colorful posters, packed some sandwiches, and drove to the side of a highway just outside their city of Hyderabad in southern India. They're here to join the Bharat Jodo Yatra, the Unite India March. In a video they took that day in October, the family looks enthusiastic. 4-year-old Avni Golconda is particularly chirpy.
Avni, how are you feeling?
Nice.
Why you are here today?
To meet Rahul Gandhi.
Not only did Avni meet Rahul Gandhi that day, she also walked alongside him for a tiny part of his cross-country rally. He and his supporters have been walking for 150 days, covering more than 2,200 miles. Here's political scientist Zoya Hassan.
It is reminiscent of Mahatma Gandhi's Dandi March, which culminated in the call to civil disobedience against colonial rule.
Mahatma Gandhi walked to protest against the salt tax levied by the British. But 52-year-old Rahul Gandhi, no relation to the independence leader, is walking to protest against India's own Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and the Hindu nationalist politics of his party, the BJP.
The BJP thinks they can divide this country along religious lines, along its languages. This country cannot be divided.
Gandhi's Congress Party is positioning itself as an antidote to the BJP's idea of a Hindu India. Many of Modi's policies are seen as anti-Muslim. Under him, attacks on minorities have increased and religious divisions are on the rise. This is the kind of visceral hate that Gandhi wants to counter through his Unite India March.
Nafrat ke bazaar mein mohabbat ki dukaan khol raha hoon.
In this market of hate, I'm setting up a shop of love, Gandhi said during the march. Along the way, he's raised a number of other issues too. Rising inflation, high unemployment, curbs on the Indian media. Zoya Hassan says he and his Congress party are getting more support than expected.
There is an indication that Congress is serious, which was not the feeling that people would have had over the last 9 years.
That's because the party in recent years has been reduced to a shadow of its former self. It gave India some of its most famous prime ministers, including Gandhi's father, grandmother, and great-grandfather. But Modi's victory in 2014 shattered the party. Today it controls only 3 states, and Gandhi himself has never been very popular. But his walkathon may be changing that.
People like the idea of a leader going to the people, rather than people going to the leader and asking something from him or her.
Why I started liking his leadership is he's truthful and honest.
That's Satish Kolkunda, who attended the rally near Hyderabad. He was particularly impressed when, during a virtual meeting with party volunteers, Gandhi told them to question him if they thought he was wrong. And the Gandhi family has been criticized for controlling the Congress party for many years. In October, the party selected its first non-Gandhi chief in 24 years.
It would indicate that Congress is turning a page.
That fresh start is crucial. Congress is the biggest opposition party in India. The BJP's other opponents are smaller regional parties. In recent years, a weak Congress party had resulted in the opposition becoming fragmented, which has allowed Modi to govern with an iron fist.
BJP has used both majoritarianism and authoritarian politics to reshape democracy, to distort democracy as majority rule. And by majority, it means a religious majority.
Modi's government denies these claims. The Unite India March gives a sense that the opposition is in action, says Hassan. Will it translate into more votes for them in next year's national election remains to be seen, says political commentator Rashid Kidwai.
People of India are also very emotional. Their voting behavior, so many a time they tend to be guided by these emotions. So if Rahul Gandhi can find some kind of traction on that count, then that will act as a game changer.
Gandhi's long march across India wrapped up today, but his Congress party's real work is just starting. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak.
In Peru, clashes continue between protesters and police. In the capital, Lima, this weekend, there were scenes of chaos. Protesters with rocks and makeshift shields clashed with police, who responded with tear gas and rubber bullets. A 55-year-old man was killed on Saturday when he was struck in the head by a tear gas canister. More than 50 people have lost their lives since the protest began in December. That was after the impeachment and arrest of President Pedro Castillo. He faced corruption accusations and had illegally tried to rule by decree. Manuel Reda was in Lima over the weekend, and today he joins us from Cusco following the story. So, Manuel, after weeks of anger, what are the protesters demanding now?
So these protests started in December in the south of the country, where Pedro Castillo was very popular among the indigenous population. And at first, they were all about bringing Castillo back into office. Now that demand has kind of fallen to the wayside, and what protesters are angry about is the violence that has occurred. They're also frustrated with Peru's political system in general, and what most people want is for President Dina Boluarte, who was Castillo's replacement, to resign.
Does that seem like that's going to happen?
So far, that looks unlikely. The president actually requested last week that elections be moved up to October. Originally, elections in Peru are scheduled to take place in 2026. But unfortunately, moving up the elections is not up to the president. Congress has to make a law for that to happen. And Congress still hasn't done that. There's a lot of kind of horse trading between different factions in Congress. So a lot of bickering going on. And that's adding more fuel to the fire because people are getting frustrated.
Yeah. And meantime, these protests show no real sign of ending. How are they affecting daily life across Peru?
Protesters are putting up roadblocks on rural highways in different parts of the country, and that's starting to affect the economy. So, for example, tourists are canceling their trips to Peru on a massive scale because sometimes airports have been targeted by protesters and have become like a site of confrontations. And also agriculture is being affected. You know, for example, avocado and grape producers can't get their products on the road, can't get them out of the country. And in Lima this weekend, there was actually a small counter-protest. I spoke with Carmen Supiani, who runs a company that exports avocados.
prácticamente estamos en la quiebra. Y eso no es justo para peruanos emprendedores que la luchamos, que madrugamos, porque mi trabajo...
So what she's saying there is that her company is going broke because they're not able to meet their orders overseas. However, she still has to pay her employees. You know, she has 30 people, 30 salaries to pay, even though her company is not making its usual income.
And Manuel, do you have any sense of how many others feel this same kind of frustration with the protests?
Well, Marco, it seems to be a substantial number. I saw a recent poll that said that 45% of the population doesn't support the protests. But that doesn't mean they're in the government's corner either. The same poll says that 75% of the population wants the president to resign.
And based on what you've seen and heard in your reporting, what do you think comes next?
Well, unfortunately, I think there's going to be more violence if the Congress doesn't get its act together quickly and organize a law to have new elections. The military said in a statement last week that now they're going to help police to clear roadblocks in the country. And the protesters are digging in with daily marches in Lima and even work stoppages in some smaller cities across the country.
Reporter Manuel Rueda bringing us the latest news on the political crisis unfolding in Peru. He joined us from Cusco. Thank you very much, Manuel. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we've got you covered on tennis news. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Remember the Pandora Papers? When they were leaked a year and a half ago, exposing bribery and corruption at the highest levels across the globe, there was one figure in Monaco who had his fingers in a lot of pockets, Saman Asani, a polished-looking businessman, but one who was exposed for bribing government officials across the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and Africa. In a courtroom in Houston today, Asani was sentenced to 1 year and 1 day in prison, then supervised release, and $1.5 million in penalties. We spoke with James Koukios just before the verdict was handed down. Koukios was a prosecutor at the Department of Justice, running Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases for 10 years. I asked him to explain what exactly Asani did to get in trouble.
Asani worked for a Monaco-based company called Unioil, which was really a third-party intermediary between various oil and gas companies and state-owned enterprises and other parts of the government. It's a very large list of countries where the DOJ alleges that Asani was involved in bribery. We have Algeria, Angola, Azerbaijan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Iran, Iraq, Kazakhstan, Libya, and Syria. So probably any of those could be considered brazen, but the breadth of geography is pretty wide. And really what they did was they purported to help get contracts and other business in the oil and gas industry in those countries. The allegations that DOJ has brought, as well as the Serious Fraud Office in the UK, is that they really weren't performing legitimate services. They were essentially being used to pay bribes.
And so what did Asani actually do?
Mm-hmm. Well, he is accused of actually delivering bribes on behalf of these very large oil and gas companies or oil and gas services companies to various officials in the countries I just named. Many of them were state-owned enterprises that operate the oil and gas industries in those countries. And he was accused of arranging for bribes to be paid to those officials in exchange for giving contracts or other kinds of business to the oil and gas majors or the oil and gas services companies. Oftentimes, according to the charging documents, he laundered the money. They used, for example, shell companies that were set up for the officials to pay money to them. He's also alleged to have obstructed justice as part of the investigation once the authorities started looking into this to try to cover up what he's done.
And what was the motivation for any company to get Asani in their employ and Unioil to make these bribes? Was it like plausible deniability?
So, you know, back in the day, prior to 1977, foreign bribery was not illegal. And a lot of major companies had slush funds or even cash desks that were set up. Their executives could go in, take out a bag of cash, fly to another country and deliver it in exchange for business. But after there was increased scrutiny on bribery and foreign bribery was made illegal in the United States and our major trading partners, obviously you couldn't do that anymore. And so you needed to have something of a fig leaf in order to pay those bribes. And the number one risk when it comes to foreign bribery is that third parties are being used to do this. And so if you hire somebody for consulting services, that's a very common way for bribes to be laundered. Mm. In some instances, consulting work can be intangible, hard to quantify, and so you can disguise bribe payments through things like consulting payments or sales agency fees and things of that nature, where the third party is actually delivering the money for you. I was a prosecutor for quite a while, as you mentioned at the outset, and I remember when I first became an FCPA prosecutor, every case seemed to involve a consultant.
So part of his sentence is a cooperation deal with prosecutors. If you're a prosecutor talking with Asani, where do you take this next?
Sure. Well, you know, prosecutors always do what they've done since Watergate, which is where the FCPA had its origins, is follow the money. And so really, when you find one third-party agent that's being used in a particular country or a particular industry, you ask, who else is using them?
James Koukios is a former prosecutor for the Department of Justice, where he pursued Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases. Today, he's a partner at Morrison Foerster in Washington. James, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
For the past couple of weeks, Melbourne has been the center of the tennis world. The Australian Open, one of the four Grand Slam contests, wrapped up this weekend. The world's Bianca Hillier has a tally on the results as well as the geopolitics.
Novak Djokovic has come a long way in the last 12 months.
Novak Djokovic has been deported from Australia overnight, throwing the Australian Open into chaos.
The Serbian tennis pro was sent packing at last year's Australian Open after he arrived in the country sans COVID vaccination. This year, the COVID regulations were gone and Djokovic returned with a bang. The newly minted world number one played what he calls some of the best tennis of his life on Sunday, securing his 10th Australian Open win and 22nd Grand Slam title. That ties Rafael Nadal's record. After the win, Djokovic admitted he wasn't sure if Australians would welcome him back.
After last year's events, coming back to Australia, I was curious and a bit more nervous than normal. What is the kind of a reception I'll get on the court, off the court? And overall, it was a very positive experience. I'm very grateful for that.
It was far from an easy ride, though. Djokovic battled a significant hamstring injury that flared up mid-tournament. And off the court, his father, Serjan, got widespread backlash for posing with pro-Putin flags outside the arena. Before the finals, Djokovic tried to clear the air.
We're against the war. We never support any violence or any war.
But the fallout continued. Ukraine's ambassador to Australia urged tennis officials to ban Serjan. Tournament heads declined to do so. Still, the Djokovic family decided that dad wouldn't attend the final match. Novak Djokovic shared what that meant to him after the win.
That hurts him and me a lot because, you know, these are very special, unique moments that who knows if they repeat again. So this was not easy for him. And I saw him after the match, of course, and he was not feeling his best, let's say, even though he was very happy to hug me and, of course, with everything. But I could see that he's a bit sad.
Fallout from Russia's invasion of Ukraine also made its way into the women's finals, where Kazakhstan's Elena Rybakina fell short to Aryna Sabalenka. Belarus-born Sabalenka came from behind to win in three sets. She's the first player to win a Grand Slam title under a neutral flag, which all Belarusian and Russian players have to do in retaliation for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Sabalenka largely avoided political questions before the finals, and after the win, she didn't have much to add.
Is it strange to win it and not have your flag somewhere or not have BLR after your name on the trophy?
Well, I think everyone still knows that I'm Belarusian player, and that's it.
Sabalenka's win has reopened the debate on whether or not Russian and Belarusian players should be allowed to compete at Grand Slams. Athletes from those countries were banned from Wimbledon last year, but other tournaments have taken the Australian Open's route of enforcing neutral flags. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has not specifically commented on tennis, but he recently asked the International Olympic Committee to ban Russians and Belarusians from the next Summer Games. He said, quote, "There is no such thing as neutrality when a war like this is going on. It's obvious that any neutral flag of Russian athletes is stained with blood." For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. 100 years ago today, Turkey and Greece agreed to swap millions of people across the Aegean Sea. Christians were sent west to Greece, Muslims to Turkey. The scars are still felt by people who didn't know their grandparents.
And you know what? I don't even have pictures. I don't even know how they look like.
Missing Family Chapters, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In recent weeks, we've been hearing a lot about declining birth rates. In nations like China and Japan, populations are both shrinking and aging. In much of sub-Saharan Africa, it's the exact opposite, especially in the continent's poorest countries. Niger in West Africa has one of the youngest populations on the planet. It also has a fragile, unstable government that is not protecting its citizens from violence. Jan Egeland is the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council and has been traveling through Niger. When we spoke recently, I asked Egeland to tell me about the people he'd met in the western town of Tillaberi, as well as in the rest of Niger, where half the population is under the age of 15.
It's not just the youngest population on Earth. It's also the poorest and, I would say, the most neglected. It's close to both Mali and Burkina Faso. So the wars in those two countries have spilled over into Niger. There are also now more and more local groups that are taking up arms or being armed by these insurgents coming across the border. Now, I met these mothers who had been walking for hours and hours to come to security in one of the towns in the countryside of Tillaberi. And they said these groups had taken over our land. They killed our livestock. They torched our homes. We're not going back.
So in this kind of state of paralysis in a place like Tillaberi, what does the city look like?
The city is now crowded. But these are generous people. We can learn from them in the high north. They integrate those being displaced. There is no camps. In every classroom, which is crammed classrooms, one third of the pupils are displaced from elsewhere. In the vocational training centers we have, where boys and girls learn plumbing, how to become electricians, mechanics for motorbikes and so on, there is displaced together with the local population. It's possible to turn things around, but then we have to have a much bigger investment from the rest of the world. And of course, this area is falling completely in the shadow of war in Europe, in Ukraine. So all of this needs to be turned around. We're here. We want to scale up. There are many non-governmental organizations who want to turn things around, but we need more investments from the rest of the world. And thank God there was a conference in Niamey, the capital of Niger, organized by Germany, Norway, and the United Nations. And there were several $100 million pledged. So that's a glimmer of hope.
And tied into education is the simple reality of a birth certificate. For many of our listeners, a birth certificate is taken for granted. In Niger, without one, many of these young people can't go to school, and it's not clear that a lot of families have that document. How do you get it if your family is poor and on the run from violence?
I mean, you're so right. The lack of civil documentation is rampant here. Two-thirds or more of children displaced have no birth certificate, meaning they don't exist, which means, again, they cannot enroll in school, which again means they will not get an identity card, which again means they cannot get employment. They cannot get they have no relationship with any government services. So one of the things we're really trying to ramp up together with local authorities is issuing systematically birth certificates, education certificates, marriage certificates. So all of that is a big quest for us now, and that is the basis also for development.
So you spoke earlier about resources. Niger is rich in natural resources. France, the former colonial power there, and corporations majority owned by the French government operate these lucrative uranium mines in the country. Why doesn't that wealth find its way to local populations?
All of those riches, the oil in other Sahelian countries, doesn't really trickle down to the population as they would in my home country, Norway. I think the solution is now systematic, good governance and international development actors helping to build good governance, including the ability to collect taxes, both from foreign companies and from the rich in these societies. There is one other enormous source here, and that is the sun. This place could be able to provide green energy far beyond the Sahel, up towards Europe later on. It's solar energy in abundance, really. This can be a way also out and provide development for local societies here in the Sahel. In the Sahara, where it's getting hotter and hotter, the sun can also be used for good things.
Jan Egeland heads the Norwegian Refugee Council and is a former UN official. He's on a fact-finding mission in Niger in West Africa, which has one of the youngest populations on the planet. He joined us from the capital, Niamey. Jan Egeland, good to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Lockbit. It's one of the world's most notorious ransomware gangs. Its members break into computer networks, lock them up, then demand money to release them. One of their most recent attacks was against the Royal Mail, the UK's largest mail delivery service. Dina Temple-Raston of the Click Here podcast took a deep dive with a researcher who spent more than a year undercover with Lockbit and found out how the group revolutionized ransomware.
Back in June 2020, an unusual announcement appeared in dark web forums. Next to all those ads for stolen credit card numbers and personally identifiable information. What it was a call for papers. The kind of call for research papers academic conferences always have.
I'm reading from their ad right now. Non-standard methods of extracting material, admin, shells, roots, bases.
This is John DiMaggio. He's a researcher at Analyst One, a threat intelligence company based in Virginia. And he remembers seeing the ad when it came out and thinking how odd it was for someone to ask a bunch of people on the dark web to write research papers.
In which you as a submitter are looking to find a new creative way to hack something or to program or code something that conducts a hacking function.
It was a weirdly highbrow way to get the attention of what was essentially an audience of cyber criminals.
They're calling it like in the name of education and the criminal community, helping out the young guys and gals coming up.
The summer paper contest, as they called it, generated a huge amount of interest. There were literally dozens and dozens of entries with titles like How We Wrote the First Ransomware for Android. The contest was sponsored, as it turns out, by a group that was pretty good at dreaming up novel ideas in cyberspace. In fact, this kind of word of mouth helped put this new Russian ransomware gang on the map. They call themselves Lockbit. And for more than a year, John DiMaggio went undercover inside their operation, watching as Lockbit grew from a ragtag gang of cybercriminals into the most prolific ransomware syndicate the world has ever seen.
Well, hackers have carried out a cyber attack against the city of LA's housing authority.
The Canadian town of St. Mary's, Ontario, has been hit by a ransomware attack.
Ransomware from a gang called Lockbit has infected Royal Mail computers used to print customs labels.
To place Lockbit in the pantheon of ransomware groups, you just need to look at the numbers. Last year, they were responsible for about 44% of the total ransomware campaigns launched. 44%. None of its competitors come anywhere close to that. But a few years ago, back when John DiMaggio first started following Lockbit, it was just a group of Russian hackers trying to make a name for themselves. So DiMaggio applied for a role there and started chatting with the group's leader, a guy who goes by the name Lockbit Sub. The only problem was, Lockbit is a Russian ransomware gang, and DiMaggio doesn't speak Russian.
So I started off the conversation with German, and of course then he says, I don't speak German. But here's the thing, all of them speak a little bit of English because those are the primary victims.
So I guess you speak German, is that the idea?
Oh, I don't. I just knew that Lockbit didn't, so that is... yeah. So I start speaking broken English. I'm like, do you speak English type of thing? And they'll be like, yes. And I'll say, okay, well, why don't we try to communicate like this? And then I just have to remember to make sure my English isn't too good as I communicate, but it works.
And what DiMaggio found was a criminal who fundamentally understood, in a way few people did, that in order for the ransomware industry to get next level, it needed to be run more like a traditional business. So Lockbit Sub, the person behind Lockbit, decided to do just that. And his first step, was to make LockBit a brand.
They constantly did things to get their name out there, and then they capitalized on opportunity.
He started with a logo, red, white, and black, a little retro looking. LockBit put it on their website, on email signatures, on the letterhead of their ransom messages. And then they tried a different kind of in real life branding.
Then they, at one point, paid people to tattoo it on their bodies, and it was for between $500 and $1,000. And I just, when I heard that, I'm like, there is no way anyone is going to tattoo the name of a ransomware brand in their logo on their bodies. And there's quite a few people who did it.
Wow.
That's just crazy to me.
Then LockBit SUP began to focus on the inefficiencies and bottlenecks in the ransomware business model. Why wasn't the average hacker launching successful attacks? And how could he address that need? His solution was something he called LockBit 2.0. Think of it as ransomware made easy, a full dashboard for the criminals to conduct attacks with easy-to-use tools. There were even push notifications that would tell attackers when a victim responded to a ransom demand. It was pretty much point and click.
He took what used to require, you know, weeks of being on a network and manually entering commands and writing scripts and stuff, and he automated it with a graphical interface for everybody.
Then LockBit's leader went further. He tackled one of the biggest problems in the cyber criminal world, paying people. It's not just about getting a victim to pay a ransom. That was relatively easy. The issue was paying all the backroom people who contributed to the attack. Traditionally, ransomware groups use subcontractors. They call them affiliates. And a lot of the time, like subcontractors more generally, they just didn't get paid.
And that was a fear, and it was a concern that was talked about a lot and still is talked about a lot on these criminal forums.
LockBit's solution? To flip the script, put the affiliates in charge, and give them ransomware for free.
You as the affiliate, you do the negotiation and collect that money yourself. And then you pay us our percentage. And that inherently gives them trust and removes that fear of getting ripped off.
Once he did that, affiliates were banging down the doors to work with them. Affiliates launch the attack, negotiate, and LockBit takes its cut. DiMaggio was watching all this happen in real time.
They like to go through the data to find sort of the most embarrassing aspects of it and share stuff. And it's very much like an online bully. It's very much, you know, picking on the victim and trying to expose their most vulnerable aspects as though it's some big joke.
But it doesn't feel like some big joke on the other end.
You feel like the world's going to end as you get into it more and more. And you think, you know, what has happened? It's like being robbed.
This guy was on the other end of that LockBit attack.
My name is Al Strathdean. I'm the mayor of the town of St. Mary's, which is a town of around 7,700 in southwestern Ontario.
St. Mary's IT department discovered hackers in the city's network in July 2022.
So they immediately isolated the system and unplugged the servers.
So when people said, hey, this is LockBit, were you stunned? Because it's kind of a big deal ransomware organization.
I was stunned, actually. And one of the interesting things about LockBit is that there has been instances where you can actually rent this software from LockBit and they take a cut, which means that it could have been anyone.
In other words, it may not have been LockBit itself that hacked them, but one of those affiliates LockBit had learned how to attract. So who does this kind of thing? That's what analyst John DiMaggio really wanted to understand, the humans behind all these attacks. And after spending more than a year lurking in their chat rooms, what he thinks he's pieced together is this. LockBit SUP is a white male living in Russia or Eastern Europe. He's in his mid to late 30s, and he grew up poor.
He says that he was picked on. So because of that, that sort of builds in these insecurities. And then when you get a lot of success, that breeds a very strong ego that is insecure.
LockBit's leader sees himself as a kind of prince of darkness, bent on sowing destruction. But for all his bravado, he's insecure, and he's really worried about getting caught.
His paranoia prevents him from ever being able to enjoy all this money that he has and all the things that he actually wants to do. He can't travel to places, and he doesn't seem happy.
Remembering that, he says, provides a roadmap on how to topple groups like LockBit. Play on the leader's paranoia. Use information campaigns against him. Make him nervous. And it's clear LockBit is paying attention to DiMaggio's research. Last week, the group posted a new photo on the criminal forums. There, in the top left-hand corner of LockBit's profile, is a smiling face. and it's none other than John DiMaggio. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina Temple-Raston is the host of Click Here, a podcast about the world of cyber and intelligence. This story was produced by Sean Powers and Will Jarvis. Authorities in Western Australia are looking for a missing object smaller than a dime, a capsule with a highly dangerous radioactive substance inside, cesium-137. It's commonly used in mining operations. Now, not only is this thing the size of a Tic Tac, the area where it could be missing is as big as California. Adding to the challenge, authorities don't know exactly when it was lost. Talk about a needle in a haystack. Still, authorities are trying to track it down.
Our immediate focus, however, now is to safely contain the material to protect the community.
That's Western Australia Health Chief Andrew Robertson. He said this capsule could remain radioactive for years and lead to serious illness if touched.
You could either end up with skin damage, including skin burns, over a period of time. And if you have it long enough near you, it could cause what's known as acute radiation sickness.
The radioactive capsule belonged to the multinational mining corporation Rio Tinto, a company that's been caught up in various controversies and scandals for years. Rio Tinto made headlines 3 years ago when it destroyed sacred caves in northwest Australia that were 46,000 years old. As far as a missing capsule of cesium, Rio Tinto says it's assisting authorities, but is also blaming one of its contractors for the mishap. The capsule fell off of a truck as it was being transported between mine sites.
Highly unusual. It's left my head in a bit of a spin.
Lauren Steen with Radiation Services Western Australia expressed her disbelief over the missing cesium capsule to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Typically, they're transported in highly protected casings. The housing is subjected to rigorous testing for vibrations, heat, high impact.
Anyone who sees the object is asked to call the authorities and to seek urgent medical assistance. 100 years ago today, Greece and Turkey reached an agreement that would change the lives of millions of people. They signed a treaty to exchange their minority populations. In other words, 1.5 million Christians living in Turkey were forced to relocate to Greece, and nearly 500,000 Muslims in Greece were deported to Turkey. This upheaval came after several years of ethnic violence and genocide during the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The world's Jerry Biscarin traveled to Turkey's Black Sea coast to locate some of the descendants of this exchange.
Olcan Gunel, a slight 23-year-old school teacher, crunches through the underbrush to peer through a tall fence. A stately 19th century home stands in the center of an overgrown garden, long abandoned.
Çünkü yaptırma masrafları çok yüksek ve bina birden fazla iki ya da üçe bölündüğü için.
The upkeep gets too expensive, Gunel says, so the houses stay empty. As we turn the corner, another mansion emerges, built with white stone and tall arched windows. This is the village of Alacham. Once a prosperous center of tobacco production on the Black Sea coast, the town's green hills are dotted with crumbling mansions. Growing up, Gunel was fascinated by these places and asked his parents what happened to their former owners.
Ama çok fazla bilgisi olan yoktu. Şaşırıyordum.
But no one really knew much about them, Gunel says. I was really surprised. But that's because Gunel's family, and most of the families who live in Alacham, moved there in 1923, after everyone else had left. Before the 20th century, the Black Sea region of what is now Turkey was filled with Greek, Armenian, and Turkish communities, who, for the most part, got along. During World War I, that all changed. Suspicions grew that local Christian minorities were conspiring with invading armies. This evolved into systematic killings and deportations of Armenians, Syriac Christians, and Greeks. Hundreds of thousands of people died. George Mavropoulos' grandfather was one of them. He died after being drafted into a labor gang.
He died at the age of 43.
In 1923, as Greece and Turkey fought over territory and refugees streamed into Greece, the two countries forged an agreement to exchange their populations. Christians would go to Greece and Muslims would go to Turkey. It didn't matter what language a family spoke, how long they lived in their hometown. This, the country's leaders decided, was the best path forward to prevent future violence. But carrying out this plan became a humanitarian nightmare, Mavropoulos says.
The Greek government did not allow the boats to come to Greece because these people from the Black Sea areas were suffering from various illnesses.
Mavropoulos, who now lives in Chicago, says his widowed grandmother was kept in an overcrowded barracks in Istanbul with her children, waiting to board the ships.
My father spoke of that experience where he witnessed so many people dying in these barracks. And I remember the expression on his face.
Mavropoulos' grandmother died not long after the family's arrival in Greece.
And for me, I did not have this pleasure of knowing grandparents. It's a huge part that is missing in my life. And you know what? I don't even have pictures. I don't even know how they look like.
Around the same time that the Mavropoulos family sailed to Greece, thousands of Muslim families made the journey in the opposite direction.
Ayrılmak zorunda kalıyorsunuz. Her şeyinizi orada bırakıyorsunuz ve tamamıyla...
Beyhan Turkoğlu's maternal grandmother came from the Greek town of Drama, the daughter of an enslaved woman of African descent. When Turkoğlu's family was forced to leave Greece and start a new life in southern Turkey, they struggled financially. Their youngest daughter had to be put up for adoption.
Belki de hani psikolojik olarak bir çöküntü yaşatmıştır diye tahmin ediyorum ki.
The separation must have been hard for my grandparents, Turkoğlu says. I wonder if that's why they were so young when they passed away. Today, a full century after these events, Turkoğlu still lives in the seaside city of Izmir and feels conflicted over this history.
Bu şeyi hatırlatıyor yani bana. Ha, belki de...
It always makes me sad, and this 100-year anniversary reminds me of that, Turkoğlu says. But maybe if it didn't happen, we wouldn't even be alive right now. For Olcan Günel, the school teacher, he spends his spare time on social media, trying to track down the descendants of people who used to live in Alaçam. When they write back, he bonds with them over shared memories of their grandparents, who made similar foods and spoke the same language. He always invites people to visit, and these connections are important to him.
Bundan da daha güzeli, uzaktan da olsa hala komşuluğumuzu devam ettirme ihtimalimiz vardı.
It's like we were neighbors who just happened to live far away from each other, Günel says. We're people in two different countries with the same culture and values. After 100 years of being pulled apart, in his own way, Günel is trying to stitch this old community back together. For the world, I'm Derya Buscarin in Alaçam, Turkey.
Finally today, it may not seem like breaking news, but on the news feed Breaking News Brazil, it is.
Que o nome do bebê seria Samba, mas o cartório não permitiu o registro.
At issue is the name of a baby, not just any baby. It's the boy that was born last week to holistic therapist Karina Barbieri and world-famous singer and actor Seu Jorge.
O Chico falou e a Rita levou o sorriso dele, o assunto. Eu sofri, seu sofrer.
It's not the birth of their son that has the celebrity news watchers' tongues a-waggin'. It's the name the parents wanted to give the boy, Samba. Yeah, seems appropriate, if maybe a little unconventional, but the registry in Sao Paulo that records new babies' names said no. Apparently, there is a 1973 law in Brazil that allows officials at local registries to reject a name for a newborn if they think it's too bizarre or might cause ridicule for the child. Seu Jorge and Barbieri are stumped. After all, there's another musician from the city of Recife who named two of his children Xerox and Fotocopia. And no one seemed to have a problem with the nickname of that great Brazilian soccer player, Kaká. Yeah, it's only a nickname, but yeah, you get my drift. If there's acceptance for that, it seems at some point, if the child is willing, Samba would make a perfectly great nickname. Or maybe the parents will appeal. Whatever happens, and until the happy family finds a name, officials will green light. At least we've got the father's actual Samba.
Testemunho ocular do esforço que eu fiz para ver tudo azul, que até carvão e giz teria final feliz na África do Sul.
Samba Soul from Brazil's Seu Jorge brings our show to a close today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.